I asked Jim, pointing to the star-shaped wings.
I honestly wouldn't know. They're identical inside and have their own kitchens, open rooms, eating, and shower facilities, Jim answers. Well, the east wing is closer to what appears to be the loading dock where the vehicles are parked. That's what I'd choose, I say, studying the map we drew.
A good point. We'll head that way, then.
So, if they have the generator going, I'm assuming that'll mean the door locks are still engaged throughout the facility, right? I ask Jim.
Yeah, all the doors, emergency lighting, alarm systems, and bare kitchen facilities operate off emergency power, Jim answers.
How are you going to get through the doors?
Bree asks.
That one's a stumper, and I've wrestled with it in my mind for some time. I have C4, but that'll make a lot of noise. I know that heat can demagnify a magnet, and therefore the magnetic locks, but that requires a significant amount of heat. And how do you do that to the side of a closed door? I've even visualized finding a blowtorch in a maintenance department there, but that's a bit unreal. The best thing I've come up with is taking down one of the guards and relieving them of their card. I'm assuming they have them in order to be able to freely move about.
Yep. Perhaps I can help you there, Jim says.
He disappears inside the aircraft and returns with an ID card.
I don't know if this is still good, but I was called back to work when the flu shots began making people sick. I brought it along in case y'all decided to go in.
Well, that's right handy.
Greg accepts the card. We cover a few more points with Jim, but a lot of it'll be on the fly. I'm just glad Lynn isn't here to hear that thought. And yes, I'm pretty sure she can hear my thoughts. She seems to have a knack for that. Well, that's not entirely true. I do wish she was here, and I'm missing her something fierce.
Sergeant Prescott and a small contingent of his group make their way over the ramp and join us. I gather Horace and Gonzalez so we can plan for tonight and tomorrow. The sun is high overhead as we gather under the meager shading by the rear lamp. I inform Prescott of the Night Runner's position in the building, to which he merely nods.
Are we going to fuel up here?
Robert asks as we settle in a lopsided circle. Bree, how are we on fuel?
We're still over half full in our tanks, Dad. The external tanks are dry, but we still have quite a bit.
Bree answers. Prescott and the others have startled looks on their faces.
Yes, that's right. You heard correctly. My kids are the crew.
I think, with a smile. So, we'll be fine on fuel. I'd rather wait until we can do a proper weight and balance. We'll have lots of folks on board along with two Humvees. The AC-130 will be stocked with any ammo we can find in the dumps at Cannon. It's only a 4 to 5 hour flight home depending on the wind, so let's wait before taking on any more fuel, I answer. We talk for a while, coming up with the plan to leave from here, conduct a sunset drop, and Robert landing with the others at Cannon AFB. Prescott will be coming with his group when we leave. Horace will lead the rest of the teams to Lubbock in the morning and park in the gully at their old location by the creek. If all goes well, we'll call them before noon and they'll meet us at whatever gate we designate. We'll figure transportation out at that point, but that's not really a worry. They'll also be in a position to back us up if we need it for any reason. We'll then return to Cannon AFB, search for the ammo dumps, load the AC-130, and leave the following day. I tell them that if they haven't heard from Greg or me by noon, they're to head back to Cannon AFB and leave. Greg and I will have to start pre-breathing oxygen on the flight down. The sun has partially settled in its afternoon position, blasting us with its heat. I look to the sky and note it's clear of clouds. It still seems a touch unreal that we're going to conduct a drop in a post-apocalyptic world. Too fucking strange. Not only that, but my son and daughter are flying me there. I'd like to go back home now, please, or at least be woken up from this very strange dream by the sound of birds chirping outside of my cottage. The sweat trickling down my back and the smoky smell of my clothes tell me that it's not to be. I forget it can still be so hot down here this late in the year. Right now, it's time to pack my gear and try to get some rest.
I grab one of the empty rucks we brought from the building and begin stuffing items into it. Ammo, fiber optic camera, C4, and a variety of fuses. Stowed separately from the C4, of course. The last thing I want is for the buffeting on the way down to bang something against a pencil fuse and ignite it next to the C4. See, the ruck will be close between my legs on the way down. You get the point. A Slim Jim I brought along, zip ties, signal mirror, first aid kit, and a few other items. I want to keep it light for our trek through the facility. I hook up the ruck to the MC4, making sure the lanyard's secure. It sure wouldn't do to release the ruck after the chute deployment and watch it tumble to the ground. Next, I gather Robert, Craig, and Bree to set up the navigation computer for the drop. I pull the oxygen masks out for them and show them how to hook up. We'll be flying unpressurized, so that's a pretty vital piece. They'll have to be alert. I'd hate for them to get hypoxic and either pass out or find we're dropping in the middle of the Caribbean. It's basically like flying any other path. You just have to keep your altitude and the needle centered. Lower the ramp 10 minutes out, turn on the red light 5 minutes out, and the green when the computer distance reads zero. Pretty easy stuff, I say. We plan the flight backwards from drop time to takeoff time. I then settle into the cockpit bunk to try and get some sleep, telling Robert to wake me an hour prior to takeoff. It's stifling inside, but I manage to fall asleep for a while. Robert wakens me with afternoon shadows filtering in through the cockpit windows. I rise and make my way to the cargo area, still feeling tired, but more refreshed than before. Everything is loaded up and the Humvees rechecked to make sure they're secure. The metallic thunk of the ramp closing seems a little too foreboding for my likes. Greg and I don our gear and hook up to the oxygen system. We settle in for the flight, if settle is even the right word. I have butterflies floating around inside thinking about what we're doing. I'm not even in the cockpit for takeoff, but I have faith in Robert, Bree, and Craig. It's been so long since I've done this, and I can't believe I'm doing it now. With the engines and aircraft rumbling, we lurch forward on the ramp and to the runway. I feel the familiar game time approaching and settle my thoughts down. The butterflies continue, but I focus my mind on the upcoming night. The engines rev, and we thunder down the runway. It seems like forever, but the nose eventually rises, and we're free of the earth. Greg and I are silent, lost in our own thoughts as the aircraft claws for altitude in the late afternoon sky. I feel us level off after a while. The heaters are keeping the aircraft warm in the cold, unpressurized altitude. There are enough portable oxygen kits for everyone, and we drone on for a short time. McCafferty walks over at one point to tell Greg and I thanks. No worries, both Greg and I reply. A sound at the rear of the aircraft draws my attention from the scenarios I'd been running through my mind. The top of the ramp lifts, and the roar of the outside thunders in. The bottom of the ramp begins to lower. The sky behind is painted in yellows and oranges as the sun drifts toward the horizon. The ground, painted in square brown shapes, is far below us. The horizon tilts as the aircraft banks to a new heading. I have a sudden deep pride for Robert and Bree. They're controlling this behemoth, and doing it well. I would swear it's an experienced crew up front. Well, they are, actually. One of the few left on Earth that could be doing this. The horizon stabilizes back to its normal position as we level off again. It's just about go time. The red light illuminates. 5 minutes. Greg and I disconnect, stand and jump to settle our gear in place, tighten straps, and make sure our gear is in place and secured. I tighten my M4 across my chest. The cargo compartment has become frigid with the warm air being sucked out of the open rear of the 130. We check each other over and shamble over to the level ramp. He leans over and shouts, "The screaming you hear on the way down will be me!" The roar threatens to carry his voice away, but I catch what he says. "And the raindrops you feel will be me," I shout back. I tighten my chin strap and make sure the clear goggles are firmly in place as I watch for the green light. The ground, rolling slowly below us from the edge of the ramp, is bathed in the dark glow of the setting sun. The western outskirts of Lubbock appear to the right. It's cold, but we won't be at altitude for long. Our free fall will take us quickly to the warmer and oxygen-rich levels. The land below grows darker as the sun hits the horizon, beginning its slow sink to mark the end of another day. The roar of the air whipping by in the engines fills the space in my mind. The red light vanishes, and the green light illuminates below it.
"See you on the ground," Greg shouts.
"Better than in it," I shout, and launch out of the aircraft into the free air. I feel myself start to tumble before old memories flood into my brain. I stabilize quickly, feeling the rush of air against my body. My clothes flap madly in the freezing air. It's a lot like jumping into a cold pond and feeling the shock of it. Brown fields stretch out below, with the city showing fully now. Long shadows paint the ground with the sun halfway down its day's final path. I turn a 180 looking for the white-roofed compound that is our target, picking it up immediately to the side, side being relative here. The familiar roar of the wind rushes into my ears. It's amazing just how old things can come back instantaneously. And just like riding a bike. Greg is about at my altitude and he adjusts to bring us close together. We won't have much time on our little journey down as we reach our terminal velocity. We're falling at close to 120 miles per hour, almost 200 feet a second. I just hope we aren't observed as it's not entirely dark. I look up and see the 130, high above us, finish a turn and begin heading back to Cannon AFB.
"Be safe," I whisper.
I look down and see the ground drawing closer by the second. A glance at my altimeter tells me we don't have much longer until we deploy. I already feel the warmer air. I think momentarily of other times and the places I've had to do this before, the adrenaline that always accompanied this kind of drop and mission. I don't have time to let my mind meander much beyond the recognizable feeling. If I think beyond the immediate moment, the next thing I'd see would be the walls of the prison flashing by, and that would be it, without even enough time for an, "Oh, shit!" My fatigues whip as if they're trying to leave my body. The needle on my altimeter decreases non-stop. It looks like we're right on the money as far as being positioned, so I don't contemplate deploying at a higher altitude and keep dropping. We're approaching our deployment altitude. Greg waves his arms from his chest out. He repeats it again, letting me know to clear the area as he's going to deploy. I turn slightly to gain some separation. He reaches down and throws his pilot chute into the slipstream and immediately vanishes upwards. Not that he went up, mind you, it just appears that way. He's still falling. I count a second longer and reach down to deploy mine as soon as I see him disappear. This will give us some altitude separation. I notice a faint glow of lights from the eastern wing windows on the ground floor. The other wing remains dark. It appears our guess was correct, and that's where we'll make for. It also means there's a measure of power from a generator located somewhere. There's a tangle of large pipes and assorted obstacles, but I find a large open area. I look around the yard, lost for the most part in the gloom of the evening, searching for anyone outside or some sign that we've been spotted. The large area between the buildings and the walls appears clear. I focus on the landing. There isn't any wind, so my inbound direction is left to my discretion. It's light enough that we don't need to deploy the NVGs mounted on our helmets, but I wouldn't need those in any case. My landing spot draws close, and I flare just above the ground, taking a few steps until I stop. I drop the handles and release the chute, which falls to the roof, draping over pipes and air vents. I move out of the way, and Greg lands a moment later. We gather our chutes and shrug off our packs, stuffing them under several pipes. We then gather our gear and look around.
Michael wakes just like he has so many nights before, present to the other packs in the area that are waking and readying for the nightly hunt. He tamps the thought to the back of his mind and scampers through the main store. This night is different, though, as he looks to the shelves, some a little bare, but all still with packages of some sort. He knows a lot of them hold food, and some of them definitely don't. He could just sit inside again and break item after item and fill himself. The store holds evidence of the night before when he did just that. Broken bags lie in some aisles, while others hold torn and twisted cans. Some cans lie near the outside walls, where he bashed them until their contents fell to the ground. Some aromas of that food linger in the still air. Tonight, he wants to hunt. He wants the rush of the chase and the thrill of the catch. Michael wants to smell the musky scent of prey and the sweet taste of flesh and blood. With excitement building, he heads out of the broken doors and into the chilly parking lot. The remains of his previous pack members lie decaying on the pavement where they fell. The memory of that night is still fresh. Sniffing the air, he sets off toward a lingering scent of food, his feet pounding the hard pavement as he sets off into the night. Running down a street, chasing a particularly elusive scent, a flash erupts near one of the buildings, turning the night into day for a brief moment. Adrenaline floods his system immediately, bringing him into a fight-or-flight mode. He changes direction in mid-step and hides in a recessed doorway. The flash he recognizes from nights prior, but still doesn't know what causes it. It's like the flashes from the stick the two-legged ones carry, but there isn't the resounding boom that follows. He edges out of his hiding place and looks to where the light came from. He sniffs and tests the night air. Nothing out of the ordinary other than the trail he is following and a stale odor of a pack that passed this way a while ago. He looks and doesn't see anything moving. Cautiously, he steps out from the doorway onto the sidewalk, ready to dart back at a moment's notice. Nothing happens. Michael walks into the street, watchful for any movement. Curiosity takes hold, and he walks slowly over to the area. His muscles tighten as he draws near the source of the light. There, on the wall of a building close to the street, he sees something attached. He walks closer, stepping up on the sidewalk, still mindful of the flash of light just prior to losing his pack and almost his life. This, however, is just the light without the roaring explosion. Stepping in front of the object, the light flashes again, leaving the aftermath of a bright spot of light in his sight and ruining his night vision. He leaps and starts running down the street, but halts after a moment. His night vision returns. He's still alive. The curiosity takes hold again, and he warily walks back, keeping to the side of the object this time. It doesn't flash. He looks hard at the object on the wall, about chest high. Somehow, and he doesn't know how, Michael grasps it's from the two-legged ones. A very faint, lingering odor from them is attached to the object. Along with the awareness that it's from the dangerous two-legged ones, he understands it is not here for the good of his kind. It takes some doing, but he pries it from where it rests and throws it on the ground with a loud cracking sound. There is a little sound of glass shattering, and pieces shoot out from the object. He quickly waves his hand over it, but there is no accompanying bright light. He opens himself quickly to the others, sending an image message to destroy the objects if they're found. Tucking the others in the back of his mind again, he sets off on the trail he was following. She and her pack smash the glass door into a large building with the images sent the night before of a new food source fresh in her mind. She's still intrigued about the sudden appearance and then disappearance of the strong one of her kind. Sending a message to her pack, they begin to take items off the shelves and break them open. Some smell like food, while others are definitely not. A few cautious tastes, and the pack tears into those items that seem edible. She smashes a heavy metallic object to the ground, and then against a wall, trying to get it to spill its contents, anxious to find out if it's food. The can hits the wall with a thump and falls to the floor, rolling around before coming to a stop. The awareness she felt last night suddenly materializes again. A flurry of images enters her mind. They are spoken in a simplistic method so all understand. They are pictures of a certain kind of object that emits bright flashes along with a message to destroy them. She hasn't seen the objects nor witnessed the bright lights mentioned. What does process is that she will take her pack west tomorrow night to get closer to this strong one. Tonight, they will hunt in this place and begin the journey on waking the next night. She knows it will be a far trek, but they should be able to make it before the bright, painful light appears in the sky. She sends the information to her pack. They stop what they're doing to listen, and then rip into the packages again. The awareness vanishes as suddenly as it appeared. The next night, the pack wakes. She turns back at the door to look at their lair after the others have passed outside. She's worried about leaving their shelter, but will lead her pack westward nonetheless. With a last look, she turns and heads out into the night. They stop at the store to pick up items from their new food source. She tells the pack that they will carry their food and to find items to bring with them. There will be no hunt tonight, yet they must eat. It will be a long journey, and they will need food to sustain them. The pack rushes in to gather items and rejoins her in the parking lot shortly thereafter. She rubs her stomach and worries about the effects of the long journey on her young one. She is strong and thinks she will be okay. The pack follows her as she heads down one of the large, hard paths leading in the direction of the one she sensed. She paces the pack, alternating between a jogging run and walking as they travel beneath the dark night lit by the other light in the sky. She feels a tingling on her skin from the bright white light hanging in the night sky, but it's only a very small sensation, more of an awareness than anything else. The night is silent, with the exception of feet slapping the pavement behind her when they break into a trot. The hours pass. They are a large pack running beside trees pressed up against the side of the path. Their passage is marked by the sound of their feet and their ghostly shapes passing by. A strong scent of prey comes upon them. They have stopped to fill up on what they brought, but there is a hunger still. The smell brings thoughts of the hunt and the thrill of it. Sensing agitation among her pack as they want to chase the delicious aroma, she sends a message to keep on. One previous pack leader heads off into the woods with a small pack chasing after the scent. She calls to have them rejoin her, but they continue after the prey. They are a long ways away from any shelter, and she knows they will be hard-pressed to find one before the night ends. She shrugs, and the rest of the group continues on their way. Buildings begin to materialize as they draw closer to where she felt the one's presence. She knows where it came from, but feels wary about just approaching. The caution stems from the young one inside her, and her protective instinct toward it. She doesn't know the situation, as he keeps himself hidden, and she doesn't want to be relegated to just another pack member in a large pack. She finds a large building similar to the one she left at the beginning of the night. The portal opens at her touch, and, not sensing others of her kind within, she enters. She's tired, but they have made it. She hopes there is food to be in this new territory, but she also saw one of the places nearby that may have one of the new supplies of food. The night is almost over, and they will explore during the next night. But for now, they settle into a dark corner of their new lair. It's warm and dry like the last one, and will do nicely with the coming of the colder days. She feels a stirring of the one within, and rubs her belly. Tired, yet content, she falls asleep with her pack huddled around her.
A Sunday Sermon. I remove a smaller pack from within the ruck I brought. I don't want the bulk of the larger pack and didn't bring all that much gear. I quickly transfer the items from the larger pack to the smaller. "Well, that was fun," I say, as darkness almost encircles us. There's still some light as the sun hasn't completely disappeared. I hope Robert and the others make it down safely.
"Yeah, if you say so, Jack. I'm pretty sure my stomach completely dropped out of my body stepping off that ramp. It should be landing shortly, so I'd look out,"
Greg replies. I chuckle, donning my pack. "Yeah, mine too." Readying our M4s, Greg and I head to the small rectangular building rising from the roof nearby. The steel door opens outward, but it's locked. I remove the Slim Jim and set to work getting the door open. The Slim Jim has a T at the top, with one of the ends tapering to a rounded point. It's meant to wedge between the door and the jamb, and then press down with the tapered end behind the latch. The tapered end will cause the latch to recede into the door, either by pressing down or pulling. I feel the latch recede and pull the door open, putting the gear back in my pack. "Let's go to Vox," I say, as we lower our NVGs and see the top landing of a stairwell behind the door. A chilled sweep of air brushes against my cheeks. Greg and I quietly head down the concrete steps, focusing on the landings below us that lead to the ground floor. My heart is pounding in my chest, knowing that we are inside, without a real avenue of escape in case things go sour. The place is large. We can find places to hide if we're found and manage to elude any pursuers for a moment if need be. I'm also hoping Jim's card is functional. We'll need it to get through the security doors, which must abound in this place. Reaching the ground floor, another steel door with a small wire mesh window set into it exits into a wide hall. The door is flush with the jamb, so I can't use the fiber scope, but the hall is dark, which suggests that no one is using it. I lift on the bar latch to ease the weight on the hinges and open it slowly. Quickly peeking into the hall stretching in the distance on both sides, I don't see anyone. We step in. Hallways branch off to the sides at intervals, and our plan is to keep heading in an easterly direction to find the covered walkway to the east wing. We slink down the hall to our left, staying against the walls. At the first corner, I hold my signal mirror out, looking down the cross hallway. It appears empty, and we turn the corner quickly. We proceed slowly, making sure to lift our feet in order not to squeak our boots against the linoleum-tiled floor.
I keep my M4 focused down the hall, my laser making a straight line to another T-intersection in the distance. Thick wooden doors open off the hall at intervals. I test the first one and find it locked without a card swipe associated with it. There aren't any card swipe doors along the entire length. Greg is keeping a watch behind us as we creep toward the next hall. I check each door along the length, finding one that opens with my turning the knob. Approaching the intersection, I hear footsteps and voices. I can't make out what they're saying, as it's more of a murmuring. The footsteps are growing louder and definitely approaching from the side.
"Company coming from the left hall," I whisper into the radio.
"How many?"
Greg whispers.
"Not sure. More than one."
"Plan?"
I'm not sure. I don't know how many there are, but it doesn't have the sound quality to be many. We could dart into the open room and let them pass. Whether they will continue down the hall they're in or turn into ours is anyone's guess. If we let them pass and take the hall they came from, which is the direction I was planning according to the diagrams Jim gave us, then we'll have people behind us. That's not a good situation. But if they're expected somewhere or are in radio contact and they don't show up or answer, that's not good either. The beam of a flashlight appears in the cross hallway from the left, its round spot bouncing on the ground as the holder of said light walks in our direction.
"Into the room and we'll see," I say.
We open the door quietly and step into the darkened room that's lit only by the green glow of our goggles.
"How in the hell did you know they were coming? I didn't see the light until just before we ducked in, and I certainly didn't hear anything,"
Greg asks.
"Oh, I ate my lucky charms this morning,"
I answer. People are going to guess something's amiss if I keep giving hints like that out. Perhaps it's just time that I told them, but I want to tell and talk it over with Lynn first. A flash of light appears at the bottom of the door. It seems only the steel doors are flush with the floors. I fish the fiber optic cam out and slide the end under the door. To the right, I only see the bright spot of a flashlight in the hall heading our direction. I can't see anything behind it, so I still don't know how many are heading our way. I slowly but quickly withdraw the camera. I don't want the light to pick it up as they approach. Greg and I crouch a few feet from the door, training our weapons on it. Boots strike the hard floor nearby, and we hear the vestiges of a conversation taking place. The light under the door grows in intensity, fading and growing bright in intervals as the light swings in the hall. I control my breathing, focusing on the door, waiting for it to open. I don't think they discovered us, or there would have been an excited shout or tone in their voice, but you never know. If they pass by, they will definitely be behind us as we make our way to the wing, and therefore could show up at the most inopportune time. I've edged my way through guards before, but it was never a comfortable feeling. It's a very good thing no one has invented an adrenaline meter as yet, or I would have been found out every time, and would now. The light fades from underneath the door, but the sounds come abreast of it. A peal of laughter rings out, and the footsteps begin to fade. I would like to know how many are going to possibly be behind us. I sneak the cam under the door again, and look to the left. Three people fill the hall, walking away side by side with the beam of a single flashlight stretching into the hall ahead of them. Their purpose for being there is unclear, but it's not dissimilar from a patrolling guard. What they would be guarding against remains a mystery. The hall to the right is clear. I hold up three fingers. If we take them out, they'll certainly be missed. Again, I'm not too keen on them being behind us, but the risk of them being missed is too great. We'll let them pass. I watch until they turn a corner at the next intersection and disappear from sight. I open up quickly to determine if I can sense any night runners. I doubt I'll pick up anything with the people walking the halls, but want to check anyway. I don't sense anything. I pull the camera cable back in and stow it. We open the door, quietly, slip into the hall, and move toward the intersection the others came from. It's still dark in this section of the building. Checking the corner again, Greg and I move to the left. We turn down a few more hallways with a multitude of doors opening off to the sides. A corridor branches off to the right of one, with a placard on the wall reading, B-Wing. That's the one we want. A set of swinging double doors opens to a room to the left. I peek in the window, set in one of the doors, before checking the hall. The doors open to a large room filled with wheeled laundry baskets. I slink to the corner and look down the hall. A faint amount of light spills into the corridor through a small window set into the steel door blocking the hall about 40 feet down. A man sits in a plastic chair near the door, the man and chair leaning against the wall with only 2 legs of the chair touching the floor. There's no way through the door without being seen, and the only way to the wing is through the door. I almost wish we'd taken the other guards out now, but this is still probably for the better. One person sitting by the door 40 feet down. No way around, I whisper to Greg. He nods, knowing what we have to do. We're still in the dark, so we won't be seen if we enter the hall, since the small amount of light doesn't filter this far down. Greg keeps an eye behind as I edge around the corner and bring my M4 to bear. It'll make some sound, but won't carry far with all the twists and turns of the halls. I put the crosshair on his head, seeing the laser pinpoint a place just below my aim point. I had set my aim point for 100 yards, so the sight and laser are just a touch off at this distance. Not much, and certainly not enough to miss. I touch my selector switch with my thumb, verifying I'm on semi, and squeeze the trigger. The corridor lights up with a single flash, along with the muted sound of a suppressed gunshot. It lasts only a split second as the round streaks down the hall. The man jerks to the side as the bullet strikes the side of his head with great force. Blood sprays against the hall and door. The man slams against the wall next to the door and falls to the ground, toppling off the chair. The chair itself scoots across the floor, as it too tumbles to the ground. Silence fills the hall once again. Greg covers our rear as I walk toward the body, alternating my barrel between the door and the man on the ground. Neither moves. I search the body, looking for both a radio and a key card, finding only a card. I pocket the card and pick him up, throwing him over my shoulder. Thankful he has a small build. I don't want to drag the body down the hall as it would make too much noise, be slower, and leave a mark. I'm also thankful he hasn't let go as there is no way I would throw that on my shoulder. I walk back and go through one of the swinging doors, setting the body in one of the laundry baskets. I cover the body with some towels and clothing, grabbing a few of the towels to clean up the mess by the door. I won't be able to clean it entirely, but will at least not make it readily apparent what happened. I even set the chair back upright. With the mess cleared and towels thrown away, we hold at the door. A long hall stretches on the other side, ending at another similar door. Only every third light is lit, casting the hall in gloom. There are patches of darkness between the faint glows reaching the floor from above. If someone does look through the far door while we're transiting the patches of light, we'll be seen. I only hope that if there's someone guarding the far door, they're as vigilant as the one here, meaning not at all. A key card reader sits against the wall on both sides of our door. Well, here goes nothing, I say, using the key card I just picked up. I see a light flash green from the reader and hear a click of the magnetic door latch releasing. Just for grins, I test the card that Jim gave us, with the same result. I hand Greg one of the cards. Opening the door, We step quickly into the hall.
I'll head to the end and watch through the door on the far side. You keep an eye out here. I'll call you down when it's clear,
I whisper.
Roger that,
Greg replies. I creep through the dark areas and scamper through the lit ones, watching the far door, fully expecting it to open at any minute. I'm also dreading the appearance of the other three behind us. If they're patrolling, it won't take them long to get back. I almost change my mind and backtrack to take them out, but we're this far and I decide to push on. I wonder what they'll do when they come to the guard station and he's not there.
Hopefully assume he's gone to the bathroom,
I think, also hoping they have their own key cards and don't have to wait for him. Reaching the far door, I hold the mirror up to a corner. I don't want to look directly in as my silhouette will block the light and certainly get someone's attention if they're close, even though it's only a faint light. I see the legs of another guard in a position similar to the last one.
This'll have to be quick,
I think. I don't see anything other than another few feet of hall that ends in a T intersection. Two sets of steel double doors are set against the far wall, with light emanating from the wire mesh windows set into them. Another steel door opens to the left, just before the intersection. Other than the one guard, the area's clear. I'm hoping the guard will think it's the others returning and react slowly.
One guard, I'm going in,
I tell Greg in a whisper.
Copy that. All clear here,
he responds. I shoulder my M4 and take out my suppressed 9mm. Swiping the card and hearing the telltale click, I open the door and swing immediately to my left. The guard is just beginning to lean forward. A strobe of light brightens his face, which barely has enough time to register shock. A spray of blood, brain, and chunks of skin with the hair attached splashes against the wall behind him. His head rocks backward and slams against the wall with a sickening thud. The muted sound of the shot hasn't left the confines of the concrete hall as I reach out and grab his shirt, preventing him from falling to the ground or slipping out of the chair, causing additional noise. I ease him off the chair and onto the floor, covering the rest of the hall and intersection. Nothing moves or responds.
All clear,
I call to Greg. I cover the intersection while Greg covers the distance down the hall, still covering our rear. We join up and ease the door closed.
What's that lead to?
Greg asks quietly, pointing to the security door in the wall to our left.
Got me, but we have to find a place for our friend to sleep it off.
I edge forward. The hall is dark, but the room beyond the double doors a few feet away is lit and is obviously being used. I hear a murmuring of some sort, even through the thick doors. All it takes is for those doors to swing open, and the best we can do is wave politely, as we will be directly in view. Stairs are behind the immediate door to the left. I swipe my card and pull the door open, wedging my foot against it to hold it while still covering the double doors. Greg drags the body by the shoulders to minimize a bloody streak across the floor that dragging by the ankles would cause. We deposit the body on the stairs. I undo the man's shirt and clean up the area as best and quickly as I can.
Shall we?
I point to the stairs. He shrugs and answers,
Why not?
Unslinging my M4, I check the man for a radio and, not finding one, start up the steps as Greg eases the door closed behind. I'm glad to be out of the line of sight of the double doors. It's apparent that something is happening beyond them. I'm halfway up the stairs, full of adrenaline, when I start having a very bad feeling. The guards we let pass by are weighing on my mind. If there's anything I've learned in the past, it's to listen to that little voice in my head. I was thankful every time I heeded it, and the few times I ignored it, it ended, well, let's just say it could have ended better. I stop on the stairs and turn to Greg.
What's up?
He whispers just a couple of steps behind me.
And just a funny feeling. Those three others keep entering my thoughts, and not in a good way, I say.
What do you want to do?
Greg asks.
I think we should clear our backside,
I answer. Greg nods, knowing what I mean.
Are we going hunting?
No. I think we should wait for them to come to us, I say. I'm thinking in that hallway we just came through.
Well, let's do it then,
he says, turning around. We ease the door open, checking to see if it's clear. The dimly lit hall between the two security doors is clear as well. The light turns green, and we ease back into the hall. It's dark by the near door, and we settle into the corners. We're out of the way of the door should anyone enter from our side. The green glow of the hall alternates in shades of lighter and darker greens where the light patterns differ. In our darkened corners, we wait with our thin beams of light reaching across the expanse and converging on the far doors. Time passes, seemingly taking forever, and I start thinking that perhaps I was wrong, but the feeling still remains.
Are you sure about this?
Greg asks after a while passes.
No, not really, but I still have the same feeling, and
I begin to say, and pause as I see the far door swing open. Three people step into the hall with the last one holding the door open. The other two pause, not having the faintest clue that they have lasers, which can only be seen through our NVGs, painting their chests. The third man hollers back through the door he's holding open.
Tim, you lazy ass, we're heading back!
He shakes his head and closes the door. I'm not sure how they could have missed a blood smear or two, but perhaps they didn't look very hard. Most likely they only noticed their buddy was gone and assumed it was by his own volition. They start down the hall toward us, with their rifles carried casually.
You have the left, I'll take the right. We both have the lummox in back. Wait for my call, I say.
Our vox allows us to talk without pressing the mic button, and as such doesn't require any movement. The third person is partially hidden behind his buddies, and us both taking the shot subsequently will increase the chances he will go down quickly after. It really depends on how the bodies of the two in front fall. I know we're pretty well hidden, but the one in front does have a flashlight, which he's holding haphazardly, and the beam is shining only a little ways in front of the group. They don't really need it in the hall, so he isn't using it to light their way. If he does bring it up, we'll be right in its path. They walk on, having snippets of conversation between them. Their boots striking the floor echoes off the concrete walls of the corridor. I feel my heart, but control my breathing, keeping my sight directly on the center of the man on the right's chest. Greg's beam holds steady. They have no idea what they're strolling toward. The flashlight beam begins to rise toward the door between Greg and me.
Now, I whisper, putting tension on the trigger.
Two muffled barks join the echo of the steps in the hall. Our darkened corner erupts with two simultaneous flashes of light. Two subsonic rounds fly out from the once dark corners and converge quickly with their intended targets. The bullets enter each man's chest and rip into the softer interior of their chest cavities, tearing through tissue and destroying veins and arteries. The pulverized rounds exit from different locations in their backs, creating large exit wounds through which blood and pieces of organs spew outward. Each man is launched backward with a grunt and hits the ground with a thud. The flashlight spins upward in the air, turning end over end. The third man looks at the man on his left, who was suddenly launched behind him and dropped to the ground with a what-the-fuck expression. He begins to turn to the other one when his head absorbs two rounds that sped outward shortly after the first two began their journey. His face disappears behind a mist of blood. The two rounds do their extensive damage, completely removing the back and side of his head. Blood, tissue, and bone shower the air behind him. He stands for a moment with his body disbelieving the fact that it is already dead and falls to the side. I'm immediately on my feet, rushing toward the downed bodies.
You have the door. I have these,
I say, walking quickly toward the downed men with the barrel of my M4 shifting minutely, covering each of them. One man on the left groans and attempts to roll over. I fire into his slightly raised head, splattering the insides of it across the once clean floor. The spray makes a long pattern of a red, chunky mass across the linoleum. He immediately stops moving.
"Door's clear," Greg whispers.
The familiar smell of someone, or all of them, letting loose, fills the hall by the bodies, mingling with the iron smell of a vast amount of spilled blood. Death hangs over the area. Pools of blood surround the bodies along with red splash patterns on the walls. In all, it's a mess. There's no way to clean this up, but I feel more of a calm settle in knowing that our back is clear. I quickly check each of them for a radio and don't find one. At least no one will be expecting a call or a response from them.
I just really hope these people were actually doing wrong, and we didn't just take out 5 people simply trying to survive,
I think, looking down at the bodies that were having a conversation just minutes ago. I've done some things in the past that I'm not terribly proud of, and those moments haunt me from time to time. I don't keep from telling my stories, especially to my kids, because I'm trying to hide something from anyone. I don't tell them because I'd rather not remember them myself. There was a lot we did right, but there was some that, looking back, perhaps wasn't so right. I really wish I could look back and think every mission and everything we did was with us wearing a halo and unfurling our golden wings, but that just isn't true. Some were people who were just trying to do their job and get through another day. They were just at the wrong place at the wrong time, and all because we wanted pieces of paper or information. Most of them were really scumbags, though. I really hope that's the case here. I shake my head, pulling back into myself. My game face, while never really leaving, returns. We have a long ways to go, and the night has just begun. I begin dragging the bodies one by one toward the far door, leaving wide streaks and swaths of blood and gore. Sweating, I load the last body into a laundry basket. There's no way to clean the hall effectively, so I leave the streaks and puddles and rejoin Greg.
Fuck, I am already tired, I say. Getting old, are you?
Greg says with a smile.
I'll answer yes if that'll make you carry me, I answer.
He looks me up and down.
I don't know if I could. You look like you've been eating everything that isn't nailed down. I don't even have a good comeback to that, so I'll just resort to the old standby. Fuck off, I say.
I hear his chuckle as we swiftly and quietly make our way through the door and to the stairs once again.
Elderly first.
He holds the door to the stairs. I slap my ass, implying he should kneel down and kiss it. We step over the body and make our way up the stairs. A top landing leads to a short hall to the right with another security door at the end. Light shines through the small wire mesh window, dim but brighter than the hall. I edge up to the window and peer through. The door leads to a small control room of some sort, which overlooks a large area, and I mean a large area. The small room itself is dark with light coming from the large room. Swiping the key card, the door opens with a metallic clink. Opening the door, a sudden loud voice comes from the room below. I freeze. The voice continues, as if orating, and not a shout of discovery. I can't make out the words from here, just that it's talking loudly. I ease into the room in a crouch with Greg right behind, easing the door closed. A console of some sort occupies the room away from the door, and large windows, again with wire mesh, look out. Each side of the room has a door leading to a catwalk that surrounds the entire room below. Other small rooms, like the one we're in, are situated on each wall, with the catwalk connecting each one. The room below isn't brightly lit, but it's well enough to see by. We lift our NVGs and peek over the edge of the console. The room below us is absolutely vast, complete with a jogging track, basketball courts, and a place for weights and tables. It looks like this is the prisoner's outside yard. In the middle of the cavernous room, a man stands on wooden boxes, addressing a large group of about 30 men, the majority armed with AR-15-style weapons. Another group of about 10 stands behind the man, holding their weapons. While not at the ready, they aren't relaxed either. The one thing that catches my attention is another man being held between two others in front of the man orating. The held man has his head hanging down, and it appears he's being held upright by the two men at his side. Another man stands in front of the one being held, staring up at the orator. All in all, it doesn't look like anything pretty is happening down there.
Shall we hear what he has to say?
I ask, nodding toward one of the doors.
My curiosity's piqued, Greg answers.
I open the door that is on the side of the group of people below us. Luckily, the door opens inward, or it would be easy for the movement to catch the eye of the man on the makeshift podium and those behind him. Lowering ourselves to the ground, Greg and I crawl side by side onto the catwalk, holding the door open with our legs. The man's voice takes on actual words.
You standing here are the chosen ones. You are pure because you answered the call and joined right away. Only you, therefore, are clean and pure. The others must be cleansed and purified. God has spoken to me. I know my destiny and act as his obedient servant. The time of the cleansing is upon us,
he shouts across the yard, raising his arms. Lying on the grating of the catwalk, Greg and I look at each other with raised eyebrows.
You only need look at the others who run in the night to know this for truth. They fear the light of day and God's wrath. They have been cursed and their uncleanliness shown. The world was long coming to this moment, and it's up to us to keep the faith and clean the world of its impurities. God has set each of us here to this task. I will lead you to the true heaven on earth,
he continues. There's general cheering from the crowd.
I count 28 in the crowd, 10 behind the man, and 3 around the man in front plus him,
Greg whispers.
That's what I have, I respond, and not one is female.
But brothers, we also have unclean ones who walk in the day. They are no less cursed than the ones who roam the night. God called you here at the beginning so we can tell the clean from the cursed. Do you repent and seek to be purified?
The orating man shouts and points a finger at the one being held in front of him. The man doesn't answer, but continues to hold his head down. The man on the podium nods to the one in front of the held man. I hear the sound of his fist connecting with a cheek from up here. The held man's head rocks, and he slumps even further.
You will be purified regardless, but to truly be clean, you must submit,
the man on the boxes says, but this time without shouting. There's movement to the side of the group, and a woman held between two other men is brought forward. Seeing the bloodied man, she wails. She begins to thrash, trying to shake off the hands holding her, but it does no good.
To submit and be clean, you must willingly turn your wife over to us,
the speaker says, pointing to the woman being held. The man raises his head for the first time. New and old blood mingle on his face from his nose and mouth. One eye is nearly shut. He looks out to the crowd and then over to his wife, angling his head to see through his good eye. The woman screams again.
Never,
the man says. The word coming out of the man's bloodied and swollen mouth is slurred, but very clear.
We'll take her anyway, but this is for your own soul. Submit and be cleansed, the speaking man shouts.
The others in the crowd are watching this unfold with an eager intensity. Any worried feelings I had about taking the others down quickly vanish.
Chris, do it! Please!
The woman implores. The man shakes his head and looks back to the ground at his feet. The speaking man nods again, and the bloodied man's shirt is cut from his back. Reaching beside the boxes, the one who belted him before retrieves a whip.
This is all kinds of fucked up, Greg states.
Yeah, you have that right, I reply, watching the scene below.
My mind is furiously working on scenarios to take care of things before they get uglier, but I've yet to come up with something that'll be effective. There are over 40 armed men below, and only two of us. If the men were separated, or we could get at them in smaller groups, then there would be 100 things we could do. Greg and I have 2 grenades apiece, and 4 grenades would pretty much clear the room, seeing how they're all gathered. But that would also mean the man and woman would be taken out, so the point becomes rather moot.
That man deserves to be saved, Greg says, as does the woman.
I know, I reply.
Well, what's the plan? What are we going to do?
Greg asks.
Nothing, I reply with a sigh.
I hate saying those words. A feeling of hopelessness sinks inside me, knowing there isn't much we can do right now. But that doesn't mean we won't be doing anything. My jaw clenches and I feel my teeth grind. I would like nothing more right now than to wrap my hands around the jerk spilling hot air from the boxes and make it slow.
We're just gonna let this happen? Greg asks incredulously.
I look Greg directly in the eye.
Yes, we are. I don't like it. I don't like it one bit, but that's what we're going to do. If we do something now, we'll either take out those two in the process, or we'll go down, which won't help anyone.
Greg holds my eye for a moment. I sense a deep anger within him that matches my own. He releases the air held in his lungs with a deep sigh.
You're right. I've been racking my brains and can't come up with anything that doesn't include going Rambo and those two not making it through. But those fuckers are going to pay.
That they are. And we're carrying their bill, I reply. Greg is not someone I would want to mess with. With his large, muscular frame, he looks like he could rip your arms out of their sockets without much effort. His dark eyes, which mimic his dark skin, narrow, and he nods before turning back to the room below. The snap of a whip and the man's screams echo for what seems like an eternity. Just below the threshold of the man's scream comes the woman's. She's begging the man to stop. Which man she is yelling at is left to guess. She's just screaming.
Stop! Please stop!
It makes me sick inside, but I feel a cold determination settle. The man's screams fall silent.
I'll submit! I'll submit! Just please stop!
The woman cries out through her tears.
You'll submit, all right, the speaking man says with a smirk.
I hear a few chuckles from the larger group. The men behind the one speaking eye the crowd with narrowed eyes. They must be his bodyguards or something. They appear to be looking for any dissension within the crowd. The whip flies through the air again and snaps against the man's back. There is no resulting scream this time, except from the woman. The man's legs give out and his body slumps further. The two holding him are now supporting his entire weight. They lower him to the floor with the woman wailing nonstop. She thrashes against those holding her, wanting to reach her husband.
Take him back to his room. You may share the woman,
the preacher says. He steps off the boxes and walks across the room to a door to our left. The entourage of 10 men follows in his wake. 2 men pick up the man lying on the floor and drag him in the opposite direction. They carry him through a door at the far end. The woman is dragged screaming and thrashing through the side doors the preacher exited. The crowd breaks up and heads into those same doors. The room empties and falls silent. The only evidence that anything took place is small patches of red on the waxed wooden floor where the man was held.
Again, I say, that was majorly fucked up. This place is all kinds of fucked up,
Greg whispers through clenched teeth.
Agreed. Let's go get those people out of here, I say. What are you thinking?
Greg asks as we continue lying on the grating, looking out over the now empty room.
Well, they dragged that poor soul through those doors, taking him back to his room, I say, nodding at the doors to the right.
The others exited through the ones to the left, so I'm guessing they keep their room separate from the prisoners.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. That's with the exception of that woman,
Greg comments. So, we get those we can to a safe place and see, I say. The 2 men who dragged the either dead or unconscious man emerge from the doors and cross the room. They're casually carrying their carbines, and their murmured conversation drifts upward from the room. They disappear through the left-hand doors. Shall we? I say, after they leave the room below in silence once again.
Lead on, Greg replies.
We crawl backward, close the door, and don our goggles. Stepping over the body once again on our way down the stairs, we emerge into the hall. At the double steel doors leading into the humongous room, the hallway branches left and right. We silently step to the corner and peer around. Another security door sits 20 feet down the hall to the right. A similar door sits in the hall on the other side. I move down the hall to the right, with Greg keeping an eye on the door behind. A darkened hall stretches away before arcing to the left and vanishing out of sight. I swipe the card to open the door, and we're swiftly through. The corridor is empty, without any doors leading off. We creep quietly down the pitch-black stretch, seen only in a green glow. We follow the arc around to where it ends with another security door. Light shines through the inset window. I'm not worried about cameras in the darkened areas of the building. They have to be up and running in the lit areas as part of the security system, though. Whether they're being watched is something altogether different. The one good and bad thing about having thick walls and so many security doors is sound doesn't carry far. At the door, I look quickly inside. I can't see much due to the restrictive nature of the small window, but it appears to be another hall. This must be the hall between the wing buildings and where they dragged the poor bastard. The actual building with the cells radiating outward like tentacles must be to the right. If the prisoners are being held there, then I assume there are also guards with them. Even though the cell doors, where I again assume they're being held, must be locked, they would also post guards. That only makes sense. The images of the scene in the large room flash through my mind. I feel a deep, cold anger settle. I cannot fathom the reason people can be so cruel when the rules are lifted. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. The line trickles through my head. Not today.